Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Tunnel Vision, a show brought to you by USCFootball.com. I'm your host, Keely Orr, joined by Shotgun Spratling, and a special guest in the studio today, Fox Sports and The Athletic. Bruce Feldman is in the studio, filling in for Ryan Abraham, the slacker who didn't show up today. But Bruce, thank you so much for showing up today.
I feel like you guys replaced one guy who graduated high school in the 80s with another guy. So
it's a big improvement, though, you know, getting you over Ryan. So.
I know. I'm actually technically a little younger than Ryan, but, so I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much. Today, we're going to be talking about, of course, USC, but you're a national guy, so we want to talk about the national perspective, especially USC and how they're viewed from that perspective. We're going to be talking about some news that you broke today, some news that also broke about Jalen Phillips. We'll talk about that. And of course, I believe we are live on all three streams, YouTube, Periscope, and Facebook Live, so we'll be answering your questions. If you have questions specifically for Bruce, be sure to comment those. I'll be sure to answer them, or he will answer them. I'll bring them up so he can answer them. But Bruce, how's it going off season for you? What does the off season look like for you?
The off season till about the combine, which is next week, still you get like a lot of coaching turnover. It's maybe not coordinator level. It's smaller assistants, maybe guys off the field. But it gets chaotic. It used to run till about the signing day, and now it kind of stretched on a little bit more. And then it kind of goes, I'll go to the combine next week in Indianapolis and then kind of gear up for spring football. So it's the season has gotten longer. And I think part of that is because of the portal and transfers and everything like that and the coaching turnover. It used to be like about 10, 12 years ago where people would say, well, you don't, most people who covered college football also covered college basketball. But when I was at ESPN.com, I remember they had me do a blog and they were like, well, you can't really write all year round. I'm like, I'll try. And there was enough stuff to do that. Now there is for the most part. And so it's good. I mean, I don't have to cover college hoops. And there's always something that seems like it's going on.
Yeah. How was, when you get to spring ball, what is your schedule like? Do you try to get around to as many places as you can?
I do. I usually try to go out a lot in April. By then, it's later in the cycle. It's good time to get access to coaches and some players. It's a little more informal than in the season where it's just kind of a grind. Mm-hmm. So a couple of 2 years ago, I think I went on the road for like 2 weeks straight where I think I hit 10 schools. And sometimes, you know, it's a little harder on the West Coast to get in the car and just hit a bunch of places short of, you know, unless you go USC, UCLA, San Diego State or something, you're not going to like drive up to, you can do like Washington and Oregon or an Oregon State, but it's hard to kind of, you know, because the West Coast is so much further spread out than, let's say, you know, the Big Ten or the SEC. But I'll try to go to a bunch of places. It's obviously easy when you live in LA. You can hit USC and UCLA easily. And since Fox has the Pac-12 and the Big Ten and the Big 12, I'll try to hit as many of those schools as I can. Maybe if I can, I'll go, you know, somewhere in SEC or ACC country just because I haven't been there in a couple of years, and that's what I'm going to do again this year.
So this is kind of an embarrassing omission, but I actually have you on Tweet Alerts, and I feel like you never stop reporting and, like, you always have sources that you're just tweeting about. I mean, it's kind of a nerdy journalism question, but do you ever feel like you're off? Do you always feel like there's news always to be sharing?
It's not, you know what, it's not a great thing, because especially when you're married with kids, it's like, you know, you never want to be at dinner and you're playing with your texting somebody or whatever. Yeah. And I think you make the distinction of, okay, what can I deal with? What can I not? And so last week was a good example where we had a mini family vacation. We were down somewhere where there's like a water park in Orange County. And there was something going on at Oregon, which I thought I could get out in front of. And I'm waiting for somebody to get back to me and waiting. And my kids are now waiting. They want to go in the water. And eventually I'm like, all right, I just got to go. And then when I came out, I looked and I had a bunch of missed calls. And it was like, that was the time where it was not good. But at the same point, you got to be human. You know, like, I don't say you got to be a human being, but like, I give respect to people who are like always on their phone. You know, I remember asking Jay Glazer, does NFL for us, and he's a great newsbreaker with big stories, but he also has like an MMA business that he operates. I was like, how do you, like, it's easy for me to go to the gym and have my phone on, and if something happens, I can walk away or whatever. But if I'm like, if I'm him and I'm sparring with somebody, it's like, you can't, like, just, maybe you can, I don't know, but like, that's a challenge. And I watched a real sports segment. It's different in the NFL for Adam Schefter because there's so much transactional stuff. It's like all the time, free agency, everything seems to be going on. But they had this segment on him where he doesn't drive anymore because his bosses at ESPN didn't want to risk him being in the car and driving and something happens.
Wow.
And I can kind of get that because for a couple of months, you know, like I sleep with my phone where I'm expecting something to happen. And the worst feeling in the world is you look down and you missed a call because you're on the West Coast and something happened at 4:13 in the morning or something our time. And it can happen. But, you know, I mean, life's got to go on and you just kind of, you know, it's not the end of the world if you don't break every story or not. You know, there's some stuff you're not going to get. You just kind of look at it and go, okay. You know, hopefully I'll get the next one.
Yeah. And speaking of sources and your reporting, you reported today that Joe Houston is going to Alabama as a quality control staffer. It seems like the rich get richer in that sense. Like, how is Alabama able to have so much sports staff? How do they do that so well?
They are committed to playing college football at a high level as resourced as any other place in terms of what they pay for their staff and how much the resources. And you talk to other places around the country, some other schools where they all of a sudden have said, look, Alabama's doing this. We can't just have like a 22-year-old guy right off the field be like our off-field staff when they have guys who had been coaches for 30 years who, I don't want to say that the other people can't bring anything to the table, but just when you have that experience, you saw it with USC. I mean, we did a couple, our crew at Fox did a couple of USC games, and Dave Campo is a coach in Super Bowls, and just the level of expertise that sometimes guys can bring can make a difference. And I think Alabama has so many layers to that. So in the case of Joe Houston, as USC fans probably remember that name, you know, he's a South Bay guy who ended up kicking for USC probably, I don't know, 5 years ago. I don't even know if it was that long ago.
Longer than that.
Yeah.
It might be. Yeah. I hate to say it's bad. You know, I go out there and I'm like, hey, there's 18. That's John Walker. You know, it's like who was a player there in like 2003? Because you just kind of like you remember the numbers you remember, and it all kind of blurs together. You know, but Houston was a special teams assistant at Iowa State this past year. They were good. He's pretty well thought of. And he's actually one of two guys they hired today to work with their special teams coordinator. So it's not even like a school that doesn't even – some schools don't even have the full special teams guy. Maybe they divvy it up with three assistants. You know, Alabama hired Jeff Banks, who was one of the best, if not the best, special teams coordinator. If you look at what he did at Texas A&M, and now he's got two guys under him. One guy was a kicker, obviously from USC, who's had some years in the business, and then the other guy came from Virginia Tech. So that's just the level that Nick Saban seems to have everything operated on. And when you get assistants come and go, I mean, now one of their off-field guys is Major Applewhite. He was a head coach this past year. Yeah. So it's a unique place.
Yeah, they've done such a good job of being able to pull former coaches. You know, a guy gets fired and Butch Jones gets fired from Tennessee and suddenly he's on there, I think, as an intern for them. You know, just being able to add more and more great football minds in the back end is never a bad thing, obviously. I think it seems like it's become the latest edition of the arms race. So initially it was everyone's got to build this great practice facility. You got to have all these great facilities. The players have to be, you know, wild when they come on the visit. And USC was a little bit behind that. You know, the McKay Center got built a couple years ago and it felt like they were kind of, you know, late in the trend. It seems like USC's late on this trend as well, you know, with two or three recruiting staff members. Whereas I like to bring up Clemson because I counted their staff, non-coaching, on-field coaching, they have 50 people. Now, some of that is secretary, some of that is assistants and stuff, but they have a life coach, which is now my dream job, is to become someone's life coach. But they just have all these other, they have, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 people that are just focused on recruiting. And you've seen where Clemson was a quality team in the ACC, and, you know, they would be really good every 3 or 4 or 5 years. There's a lot of talent in that area, you know, pulling from Georgia and South Carolina. But they've become a consistent factor because they've invested that much in it. When did you kind of see the transition where it went from facilities to now it's, you know, it's people on staff that can add to the program?
We did a story when I was at ESPN Magazine. I want to say this is like 2008. And the story I remember was, it was one of these things where it was almost like you take the reader through like a drop-down menu of, you know, go to this, go here on Alabama's website, go down to this tab, and all of a sudden it listed all the guys who worked on the staff. And it, the story had come up because there was a coach I knew who had went and visited there. He goes, wow, they practically have like their own right tackle coach. You know, it was that specific. Now, you know, back then it was like, it's a little bit taboo where I remembered when after USC got hit with the sanctions, I knew a guy who was on the staff but was not allowed to coach at all. And they had a compliance person to make sure. And it's different. You know, you had, I don't know, 16 media members out there. And I'm not saying all 16 would have like written, oh, so-and-so is an off-field person. I saw him giving instruction to Peter McBride, the long snapper or whatever. You know, like, but there was, you know, like USC was like, hey, you can't do that. Whereas I think there was some rumblings in the SEC that some, there was some coaching going on with some of these guys where you're not allowed to be hands on. And some of these roles, you know, you mentioned about like the experience level they have. A couple of years ago, it was 2017, they had Dan Werner as an analyst. And Dan Werner had been the offensive coordinator at Ole Miss. He won a bunch, he's probably won four national titles, I think, because he was an offensive coordinator at Miami as well. And he was the offensive coordinator when Ole Miss had beaten them twice. And so Nick Saban hired him. I think he was still getting paid by Ole Miss because he got let go. And so, you know, the deferred payment. So he was a bargain for them. He's basically hired. He didn't even move to Tuscaloosa. He had an apartment there. And because he had a young child who he wasn't going to move, he would watch the games at home in Oxford, Mississippi, but he would be there. They would send him the film. There's a technology where you can watch everything and get it sent on Sunday. He would break it down, and then he'd be there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then he would leave right before practice because he physically could not coach, but he could be there for ideas and game planning and all the other stuff and make suggestions to the, at the time, the offensive coordinator was Brian Daboll. And that, like, that level of expertise and, you know, ideas, that can only help, especially when you have somebody who's really confident at the top to be like, all right, I'm going to take this. I don't, you know, like, I'm sure there's egos involved, but it's just when you have somebody who's so confident in their position, they can delegate it and handle it. And I think that it really felt like it happened like around 2008 with Alabama. You know, you felt like there was some of it going on at Florida with Urban Meyer, but not to the degree of Alabama. And then it started to spread where you'd hear other, you know, it's a copycat business, yeah, where so-and-so got fired. And now instead of being a coordinator where this other school still got to pay him $600,000, he's going to be off the field and he's going to go hang around Tennessee or whatnot. And you, and that happened more and more. And I feel like it's only recently, within like maybe the last 2 years, gotten out to at least USC, because you just don't see it. You know, I think, you know, there's maybe a handful of schools that do it in other places, but you just don't see it very often where that happens. Like Bobby Diaco, the former head coach at UConn and Notre Dame defensive coordinator, he was like an off-field guy, I think, at Oklahoma last year. But you just, Oklahoma's kind of the, I'm sorry, Alabama's kind of the gold standard when it comes to that sort of thing.
Now, USC obviously didn't have the easiest offseason this year. From it's definitely, from our perspective, we're in it a lot. We might get used to the dysfunction that is USC sometimes. From a national perspective, and from your opinion, what was the view of USC this past season and this offseason?
Well, you know, we had them three times this year, our crew. So we had them against Stanford, where they looked awful. It was week two. Yeah. We had them against an undefeated Colorado team at home, where they didn't look great, but, you know, they won that game, and they, you know, it was, I think it was the week after they had kind of had a big lead and got interesting. I forgot who they even played.
Yeah.
But then similar happened with Colorado. And then we had them against UCLA where they looked horrible. Right. I mean, they were like, you'd hear from people who were USC people who were just disgusted with how, you know, how they just played, how they acted. It just was, it just didn't feel like this was a program that really was on the right track, which is kind of, you know, I look at the poster of Sam Darnold back there, and Sam Darnold made everything look work, you know, once he got in there. And that's not a knock on Clay Helton. I mean, there's a lot of great players who cover up a lot of stuff, you know. But I think one of the things that when you saw Clay make the O-line change he made, where it was somebody who's really close to his family, that's not an easy move to make. And then to shake up the staff, I think, you know, I'm friends with a lot of USC people. And like you know, people who live in Southern California, and you can see how disgusted they are with, it's almost like they've given up. You know, the Cliff Kingsbury thing was, I think it was embarrassing to them. I think some of this stuff is the level of dysfunction at USC, and you talk to like other coaches and it kind of blows them away, because the thing that's different about USC, and this is why I will always argue USC is a top five job, even if USC goes 5-7, is because unlike every other school in college football, USC, the gap between USC and everybody else in the Pac-12 in terms of just like profile, resources, recruiting base, commitment to football is such at a higher level than the number two school. Even as much as Alabama's won under Nick Saban, it's not that different than Georgia or LSU or, you know, whatnot. And at Ohio State, you know, Ohio State, I would give probably an edge to Michigan, but it's not a huge difference between them in terms of what they're dealing with, what the recruiting base is. You know, Oklahoma, Texas, same deal, but USC's different. And the thing I'd heard from somebody who used to work at USC and coach there was like, at USC, you really have to screw it up not to get it going. And I think one of the things just from being out here, living out here almost 20 years, is they used to say when Pete Carroll was the head coach, you would see like a celebrity at practice or whatever, and it would be like, only at SC. You know, it was like, and that was a good thing, only at SC. You know, like, here's Will Ferrell at practice, here's Snoop Dogg, here's this. And a lot of cool stuff that Pete Carroll did. You know, Bill Withers shows up to like a practical joke and, you know, singing with a player. And now it's like only at SC, where some of this just weird stuff happens. You couldn't see it at a lot of other places. You could see some of the stuff, but just the level of it. I mean, and, you know, they've had three ADs in a row, and, you know, it's all been guys who are former great players, but they weren't, you know, like the administrator experience. And sometimes that shows up in how things run and how things operate and the decisions that are made. So, you know, having said all that, I like Clay Helton personally. I think he is authentic. I think he's a genuinely decent man. I'm sure there's a, like, I think this is from Ryan himself. When I remember we were in the car, this is whatever it was, 4 years ago, and we were talking about whether they were going to get Clay Helton the job or not. And I was like, well, why would you make this move right now when they did it? And his thought, and I don't know if it was just Ryan's own thought or people had been telling him this, was, well, if they hire him now, even if he loses, like, even if he loses the Pac-12 title game, which I think, you know, he did to Stanford, and then he lost to, was it Wisconsin. Nebraska, Wisconsin.
In the Holiday Bowl, yeah.
Yeah. So if, like, if they had waited, then it's really hard to hire him. But they made those moves because they wanted, and then all of a sudden, what it did was it gave everybody there who didn't believe that he was the guy, like, because USC feels like, you know, they should be able to get anybody, which, and in reality, that you'd think that, but it's hard to get coaches because you don't know what the timing's going to be. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, it's a long answer to just say it's like really dysfunctional, and, you know, you'd think they, I don't know. I just looking into this year is like, is 9-3 going to be enough? You know, I don't know.
Well, we actually had that question here was, how many wins does it take for USC to change that national perception? Because, you know, I say that, you know, I've said this several times on the show, that when you go 5-7, when you've had four losing seasons in like 60 years, that's a fireable offense. So everyone on the staff could have been fired, in my opinion. Now that you haven't done what you said when you said, well, we want to follow the Notre Dame model. We've seen Notre Dame turn it around. Well, Notre Dame fired almost everybody on that staff except for Brian Kelly. And then Lynn Swann puts out the statement that says, well, we have to make changes in personnel and coaching and like all these other things. And it doesn't really feel like they've went the full length of doing that. It seems like, well, we put the Band-Aid on it. We made this little change. We made this little change. But they didn't go full on, you know, turnover there. So what can, you know, what will change the perception if you haven't really completely flipped the program? What do you have to do to make that change?
You know, in some ways, I went to University of Miami and I covered them for a little while. I feel like Miami and USC are probably more alike than any other places because they're city schools. They have an inherently huge recruiting advantage. Now, USC has a longer history. They're not identical, but there are similarities. And the one big similarity that I feel like they have now, because USC dominated a few years after Miami dominated, and Miami's decline was like this, whereas USC's is like, USC had sanctions, Miami had a scandal. You know, they're similar. But the one point I would get to is, with Miami, it's like people are like, the U is back. Well, I would always say the U's not back until there's a parade and they won a national title, right? And I think if you're USC, USC has already won the Pac-12 and won a Rose Bowl with Clay Helton as the head coach. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if they did that in the next 2 years, because I think they have enough talent. And I don't think anybody, like, I think Washington's the best team in the conference, but it's not like the gap between Washington and everybody else is, it's not like Washington is Alabama right now. They're a really good team and they've got a great coach. But I, you know, I just don't think there's a huge gap there. And the division that USC is really bad right now. So, you know, they could win it. And then I still think there's going to be a huge chunk of your, like, the peristyle, you know, folks and other people are like, yeah, but the conference stinks. And until they win a national title or at least win a playoff game, I don't think you're getting that off Clay Helton's back. I mean, I don't think it's fair or unfair. I just think that's the reality.
Now, we get this question a lot, and I'm kind of passing it on to you. Well, Ty on Facebook says, if Clay Helton has another bad season, will they pursue Urban Meyer, and would Urban be interested?
It's a great question right now. I don't have any idea. Like, Urban Meyer's going to come work with us at Fox. You know, he'll be in L.A. at least on the weekends. I don't know how much. You know, like, just from being around him a little bit this past season – I don't know. Like, I remember hearing the story from his wife, I guess it was after the Rose Bowl, when they, you know, a couple of weeks ago or a month ago, where it didn't sound like, you know, for his own health and just the stress that comes with it, that it seemed like it was a given that he was going to come back. But he's still pretty young. And I don't think, you know, a lot of football coaches, Bob Stoops is the happiest football, retired on his own terms, football coach that I've ever seen. And Bob Stoops is coming back to at least coach in the XFL, right? So it would not surprise me if he came back. And also then you look at, okay, you just left Ohio State. You left it in a really good place. There's only about five or six jobs that are big enough. He's not going to come back to be the head coach at Arizona, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if he comes back, what are the jobs that would entice him? I mean, Notre Dame, you mentioned it. Brian Kelly's winning right now. I mean, Brian Kelly's there. He has a connection and affinity for Notre Dame. You know, I'm sure there's some, you know, Penn State's a big job, but James Franklin's, you know, is winning right there now. I don't know. You know, USC is the only job, and I don't look at him and say, oh yeah, he looks like a natural fit for USC. But, you know, if he looks at it and goes, man, I could win big here, because anybody who looks at USC and really looks at it, I'm sure they think, man, I can dominate that league. So, you know, I mean, the timing could be great for USC, or it could be really frustrating.
Do you think that's someone that USC's administration would go for, or is he kind of, you want to step back a little bit from that?
That's the problem with this. Like, who is, you know, USC's brass? Like, what kind of decision making are we talking about? It's almost like trying to predict, like, you know, what my 4-year-olds are going to want for dinner or something. You just don't, they're just hard to read. You know, it's like, I thought you wanted mac and cheese. No, it's quesadilla. Okay. You know, it's like all of a sudden now it's Jack Del Rio they want, or it was Hugh Jackson for a minute you'd hear. And you just, like, with USC, I feel like all bets are off, just because they're so, I don't say they're so predictably unpredictable, with, like, rational thought doesn't always seem like it flies there.
And I've even said that I don't think the administration and some of the different players involved want to give up the power that would be required to get a guy like Urban Meyer. Because Urban Meyer is a guy who, if he comes into a program, he takes over and he wants Nick Saban control. He wants to be able to hire all those different analysts. He wants to be, whereas USC, you know, they did hire Joe DeForest, who was an analyst for them previously. Now he's the outside linebackers coach, and Dave Campo, like you brought up. But they also still have three recruiting, full-time recruiting staff people, and they're staffing it with students. Where they don't want to put that full investment, it seems, from the outside looking in, into the program. Do you want to invest fully? And I think part of it is we're still waiting to see what the president situation happens at USC. When you hire a full-time president, then, you know, maybe you find out you know, exactly what their affinity is with football and how they see it, you know, and its place for a program like USC in, you know, in the school itself, because USC has, you know, escalated itself as an academic institution, but does the football still play into that and driving people to the pro, to the university as well?
I mean, I think that's a good point about the Urban Meyer. Like, if you're going to be in, you better be in at a different level than you're in right now. And the demands that I'm assuming somebody of that level is going to make are different than what they are right now. I mean, USC in a lot of ways, again, I go back when I first moved out here, which is the early 2000s, like USC's weight room was like a high school weight room, like an old high school weight room, right? And, you know, it was just like sometimes it thrived in spite of itself. You know, if they're going to do that, but if you're USC, if you really want to win and you got to be committed to it, you probably do need to do things differently, right? And so I don't know who the person is, and it's going to have to be a big, big money person to say, okay, we're going to make a big swing for the fences. Now, do they look at it and say, you know what, we're going to go try to find our own guy who we think is like a cutting edge. I'm not saying it's going to be like try to find their own Cliff Kingsbury, but I could see them trying to do that more than try to, I don't want to say fit a square peg into a round hole. I mean, again, it goes back to USC and kind of what they're interested in, what they're looking for. I mean, I'm not sure that they necessarily would be looking for Urban Meyer or that type at USC. I think in a lot of ways, if you just want to win, I think that would make a lot of sense. But I don't know if the USC people, you know, see it that way. I don't know. I mean, they're hard to read with this stuff.
Now, do you think, we've had a couple questions referencing USC versus UCLA. Do you think UCLA made that hire with Chip Kelly and Casey Wasserman going out and helping fund it, being the big money guy basically behind that? Because we've had a couple questions asking who you think has a brighter future ahead, both for this season upcoming and, you know, going forward.
You know, I think UCLA did make the hire USC probably should have made if they waited longer. I mean, if anybody watched that game in the Rose Bowl and looked at it, Joshua Kelly was a average FCS back. He ran for 300 yards against USC and probably could have run for another 100 the way they had schemed up USC, and there were no adjustments. And I think for people who look at it, it wasn't like when you look at the players UCLA had that they beat them with. I don't know. I mean, to me, I look at UCLA right now has a plan what they're going to do. And when people look at it and go, okay, well, they only got this many four-star guys and they only got one four-star and they didn't get any five stars. Look what goes on in Pullman, Washington. Mike Leach just won 11 games and he probably averaged like 48th or 50th in recruiting the last 3 or 4 years. And part of what I think it works is because he knows exactly, I'm not saying he's, you know, they should go hire him necessarily, but he knows exactly what he wants. Mm-hmm. And I think in Chip Kelly's case, he knows exactly what he wants. And when you look at the guys they recruited at Oregon, they never had a class that was in the top 10, but they were whatever, 46-7 and dominated the Pac-12. And I think it comes back to vision of what you're looking for. And I think sometimes we get that kind of skewed because a lot of times we look at, you know, I think the recruiting piece is really hard, you know, like to know, okay, this four-star is going to turn out to be an NFL first-round pick and this two-star guy, you know, whatever, because it's just like, you know, you don't know the character piece. You don't know how these guys are going to develop necessarily. You don't know also how they're going to fit into different systems. I mean, I remember, I think this is a conversation Ryan and I had like in the car one day where it was after the UCLA game and I went back and looked at all the guys who would be, I think they had 8 5-star guys in like from 2013 to 15. It was a 3-year window. And the closest thing to a really good player of those 5-star guys was Amon Marshall, who's, you know, started for a long time, but it wasn't like he was an All-American. Mm-hmm. And then you'd go back and see all these guys who missed. And he started, like, I had mentioned some of the names of the 4-star guys, and they were invariably, it was like an offensive lineman who I'd, you know, and Ryan goes, whoa, I forgot about that guy. You know, it'd be like that level of things. There was a few, like an Osa Messina or a Joseph Lewis who, like, had, you know, major off-field issues. But there would be, it was, you'd wonder, is like, okay, were these guys who just didn't develop, or these guys who maybe just didn't fit or whatever? And I think I come back to, you know, when you have a head coach who knows exactly what he's looking for, I would be more inclined out of bet on that guy long term than I would on the one who's trying to shoehorn a lot of stuff in and getting pressure from a lot of different places. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, like I said, I like Clay Helton personally, but I think he's in a really tricky situation. He's got, you know, as you guys know, he's got a, you know, talented quarterbacks, and he's got really good receivers and some really good players on defense, young players. But I mean, it's hard once you're on the hot seat where it's like that to go from 5-7. I mean, if you tell me he goes 9-3, I don't know how, you know, who's going to think that's going to be enough here.
And he's got a really tough schedule, obviously, with USC. Their first six games, it's going to be hard for USC to get out of that with a positive record, much less, you know, coming out unscathed or anything, and then trying to finish off the season.
Now, you mentioned development and maybe the lack of development. We actually have a question from Bob on Facebook. He says, can anyone on this show name one player that Clay Helton has developed from an above average player to a first or second round pick that didn't already have naturalized talent?
Well, they all have natural talent to begin with, or they wouldn't be a first or second round pick. Nobody goes from, you know, the kid that can't walk and chew gum in high school to suddenly become an NFL player. But, I mean, you do look at some players like a guy like Uchenna Nwosu.
Yeah.
But the thing with the USC guys that we've seen is that it's usually the guys that are very self-sufficient, you know, that are pushing themselves to take that big jump from a year to a year like Uchenna did from, you know, his sophomore year to his junior year. Because, obviously, he was a guy who left the program for a short time. You know, after his incident, I think at the Holiday Bowl, coming back, he was gone for the spring semester, came back, reinvested himself into the program. So I think it's hard to say that that's a guy necessarily you could even point out to.
And I think that's one, though, that Clancy Pendergast came in, and I remember just having known him the first time he was here, somebody he looked at and go, well, he's got good length, and looked at him and said, remember his example was he's not necessarily Anthony Barr, but he's somebody that looks a little different. And just remember having that in the back of my head. And he didn't come out and have an awesome spring, but eventually he turned out to be a very good player. I don't know where you fit in and giving, you know, you can't just put all of Sam Darnold. You got to give Clay Helton some credit for that, right? I mean, you know, he was in that class where Ricky Towne at one point was the number one recruit in the country. And then, you know, eventually the recruiting rankings shifted. But, you know, when they went with him after, you know, giving Max Brown a shot, he turned out to be a really good player for them. Beyond that, it's a tough question because, you know, again, I mean, there's a lot of guys who you expect if they're a five-star guy to come in and make a huge impact and not be like, oh, that guy was a third-round pick or, you know, whatnot. I mean, like Jay Tufele is a guy who seems like he's a really good young player, but we'll see. You know, there's been a lot of guys who like flash early on. Like, I feel like they've had like eight safeties back there, you know, like
that's because they actually have had eight safeties. It's crazy, last, you know, calendar year.
And some of those guys are talented. You just wonder, it's okay. I'm not saying they're going to develop into, you know, Polamalu, but you know, you see guys who early on, you're like, oh, you notice them. And then all of a sudden maybe this is kind of speaking to his question, but it's like they don't really, you would see that with some of the receivers, but the receivers would be gone after 3 years.
Mm. Yeah.
But outside of that position, it, you know, it doesn't feel like it's been that way. It used to be that way under Pete Carroll, but it just for one reason or another. And I think that's a function maybe of you've had, you know, 10 different line coaches in 10 years and you've had a lot of turnover. Now you're having, you know, a strength staff shake up. And yeah. I just think there's been a lack of continuity in some key places.
And you've seen, I mean, it's hard to say just an above average player because USC has recruited at such a high level the past, I don't know, 5, 6, 10 years to where it's not like there's a lot of 3 stars in each class to say, well, that guy made that big jump. I mean, you got guys like Deontay Burnett who've gone from, you know, the last guy in the class, call him on the day of signing day and flip him from Washington State, and he becomes your leading receiver. But you also have had so many of those 5-star guys that you expect to be the big producers.
Like Porter Gustin turned out to be a very good player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I'm in that class, like Cam Smith, I think there were 4-star guys. But they, you know, as long as they were healthy, they turned out to be really good, productive players. I mean, I don't think you can ask. I know Cam Smith, you know, looked up to Luke Kuechly, but not everybody can be Luke Kuechly. But I think he was a really good college player. And again, I think that's a, you know, you got to give some of those guys credit. I mean, he continually evolved from being a 260-pound guy to a, whatever, 230-pound guy who could run around a little bit.
Now, when during the regular season, you travel around to whatever team or teams you're going to cover that weekend. So you get to watch practice of a lot of schools, mm-hmm. right? So you've seen USC practice. We talk a lot about how USC practices, but we don't get as many, we don't get to see as many schools as you do. How would you rate how USC practices compared to some other schools?
Well, we sometimes, in fairness, we sometimes get teams on a, maybe a walkthrough may not be, so it's going to be throttled down a little bit. True. But definitely just from being out there in the middle of the week, you know, this is not the same USC temperament persona that it was 10 years ago. You know, right the day after the UCLA game, I got a call from somebody who is a USC guy who had been out there, I think, in a practice like a year ago. And he had said he was disgusted by what he saw. And he said, you know, back when Pete had it going, yeah, Pete was the upbeat guy, but you still had like three ass kickers on the staff. He said Kennedy, the running back coach, was that way. Ed, the D-line coach, was definitely that way. He thought Tim Davis, had the O-line coach, had some kind of an edge. And when he wasn't there, I thought there was just like, there was just an energy of practice that was different. And he said, I didn't see that. He said the only one I'd hear a little bit would be Clancy Pendergast, the defensive coordinator. But you just don't feel that same level of energy. And you could say 4 years ago or whatever it is that, okay, well, they didn't have a lot of bodies at practice, so they maybe couldn't go as hard. Yeah. I feel like those conversations probably have been had ad nauseum on your message boards and in Ryan's car, but like, that's not it anymore, right? You know, it's like that problem is that, that explanation is past.
Yeah.
So I don't know. They shook up the staff. We'll see how it goes. Like, I think Graham Harrell's a really good young coach. I don't know how it's going to fit out here, but I think he's a really good, like, if you told me that Ole Miss had just hired him as the offensive coordinator, I'd be like, ooh, that's a good hire. You know, it's just like going into USC, you know, it's not like he has his own, like, the one thing is he doesn't have his O-line coach. I mean, Drevno's still here, yeah. And how much they're going to learn about what Graham wants and everything else, that's going to be an interesting fit, because Lincoln Riley has a great offensive line coach for him and Bill Biedenboe, who played for Leach and learned under Leach and knows exactly what he wants. And I remember, this is a little bit of an apples and oranges thing, but when Will Muschamp got the Florida job, he had his O-line coach and his quarterbacks, offensive coordinator guy, were not on the same page, and it was a disaster. And if you don't have like that kind of continuity, and I feel like somewhat with USC, there's like a little bit of a disconnect, that's a challenge, you know, and that's, you know, you can be talented enough to kind of work through it. I don't know, you know, I know they're talented. I just don't know if they're that talented to kind of overcome all of it.
Interesting. So how much do you think Graham's hands are tied, given that he came so late and his offensive staff was essentially already cemented in?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a challenge. You know, I mean, to his credit now, he's got, you know, talented quarterback who's got some experience, and I think he's got really good receivers. Now I know some of the, you know, backups transfer, but I think the front end, like top three or four guys, they match up pretty much with anybody, right? And so that's a big plus. And he's got, you know, talking to other coaches, they really liked USC's tight ends that they got, that they brought in. So I don't know how Graham's going to be with that, just because that usually isn't, you know, a couple of, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, Cliff had Jason Morrow, who was a good tight end at Tech, but that's just not usually something that those guys have. But yeah. Look, I mean, I think that he's got pretty good, he's got definitely better running backs than Texas Tech has had since DeAndre Washington was there. So it's like, in this system, you know, take out the Oklahoma part of it, you usually have like good receivers and a smart quarterback who's accurate. You don't have like some of the, I don't think they have the level of receivers that USC has in terms of big athletic, you know, Pittman, what he can do. You know, I think there's a lot of opportunity there. It's just, you know, the bar is so high right now. You know, what is success? I mean, I don't know where they ranked offensively. What are they, like 90th or 80th or something?
Bad.
Yeah. So they could go, they go 30th. It's a huge plus. If you're Graham Harrell, you're kind of playing with the house's money, because, you know, they're not going to get worse.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they could have a really disappointing year and go 7-5, 8-4, and still statistically they're going to probably be, because you don't have a true freshman quarterback. Now he's a second year quarterback. You know, the receivers are there. I don't think lack of points is going to be an issue for them.
I mean, if they score seven more points in the games, then they win four of those games. I mean, they lost, you know, several tight games. But, and that's what Clay Helton used as, well, we're right there because we lost some close games. But it's close games that you're close with Cal when there's no reason that they should have been.
Right.
You know, that Cal does not have the talent to be in that game, that in that particular game. So the games that are close that they're losing, it's like, why are you even in a close game when that team shouldn't be there? But if you win those four games, you're 9-3 versus 5-7. So it's a whole different ballgame if you just add 7 points to it. Now, obviously, it's much different when you're in the game versus, you know, just adding the points as a second. But I think the offense is good enough to add, you know, 7 or 8 points per game. And how does the defense kind of react with, you know, if they go with the up-tempo, how quick are they going with the up-tempo? How does that affect the defense in that regard? I think the defense will just be better. We actually talked about it on our podcast earlier. I think the defense is going to be better by virtue of the offense will move the ball more consistently this year. Instead of when USC was bad last year, they were really bad. There would be stretches of, you know, 15, 20, 25 minutes of a game where the offense is getting one or two first downs in that entire stretch. So the defense is just constantly being put back on the field, and that, you know, the wear and tear that creates, I think by virtue of the offense maybe making some more adjustments this year under Graham Harrell, I think they'll be able to move the ball at least more efficiently, even if they don't score as many points as we hope or you expect from that offense. I think that they'll move it more and help the defense out in that regard.
I'm curious who's going to be, because of, as we said, you know, you got a coach who's clearly going to be under a lot of pressure. Who are the leaders in the locker room going to be? You know, Cam Smith is gone. Porter Gustin is gone. You could kind of feel Sedware's presence last year. He seemed like he had, you know, a little bit of an edge to him. I don't know who's going to take over on that. I mean, is that going to be JT Daniels? You would hope if you're a USC fan that it would be. You could see, you know, Amon Ra has the talent to be that guy. I don't know if it's anybody on the D-line. I remember I asked one of their assistants before, and they had mentioned one of the linebackers, and I'm trying to remember who it was, but it wasn't like a roll-off-your-tongue, you know, kind of guy there. And so that's the thing, because I think it always matters who your leaders are, but I think it's going to matter even more when there's all the scrutiny that's going to come. And it just feels like from talking to people around USC that all the stuff, like kind of the panic, paranoia, frustration that is in the fan base started to seep into the program a little bit. You know, when you started getting guys drifting into the portal and some of that other stuff of what's going on. I think the best thing that'll happen to them is they get back into spring football and just play and try to focus on being a team and having a goal. It also doesn't help when you went so long without a strength coach. In the offseason.
I mean, we've had that question from several people, actually, from Bakes on Periscope, from Loser on YouTube. Do we have a strength? Do we still not have a strength coach? And no, it's still KB. Keith Belton is still running it. Thump Belton is still running the program for them as of now. So he's in charge of the program while they go through these offseason workouts. I mean, the Twitter clips that they post, they look great. Of course, every team's Twitter post looks great in the offseason. So
I saw a nice flip from a 270-pound D lineman.
Drake Jackson, excited to see him and see his athleticism, see what he can do. But he's a guy that you're not sure exactly where you're going to play him at. You play him a defensive end, you play him an outside linebacker. He's kind of another tweener there, which they've kind of had issues with finding the right spot for guys like that. Does Christian Rector stand up? Does he put his hand on the ground? That type of thing. Same thing with Connor Murphy coming off the edge at 6'7". You know, they haven't really found a great spot for him. So that's a guy where I think his athleticism plays up and he can get to the quarterback. But where exactly does USC use him, and can they find a way to use him correctly? Which sometimes hasn't been the case with some of the guys they've had in the last few years.
It's weird because a little bit of their personnel feels like it's suited to what UCLA wants to do on defense, where they want length and they want guys who, in some ways you look at USC because they had so much success as a 4-3 team, you know, back when Ogeron was a D-line coach, and they had really good D-linemen, and they were all, it could have been inside guys or outside guys, but they had a good run of it. And then, you know, Leonard Williams was a great player. But after that, it just feels like a lot of times you see flashes of guys, but you don't, you know, I feel like that's the part that's been missing. on the defense side. There hasn't been that one guy who takes over a game and is the guy that everybody worries about. You know, I mean, Leonard Williams, they had that. I'm not saying they haven't had any good players, because Cam Smith and Gustin were good players, but that was the thing where, you know, they had that. And, you know, it's, you should be able to have that, because we do Washington and Utah games, and they got those guys,
yeah,
right? You know, so, you know, sometimes, you watch it. Utah is an interesting team to see at field level, because you watch them, you're like, I understand now, you know, because you're like, okay, that guy's a good football coach, Kyle Whittingham, but you see how physical they are. They're different than a lot of other teams. And people talk about how Stanford's physical. They're not physical like the way Utah's physical on both sides of the ball. And a lot of ways, I think if USC old fans probably wanted to see it, be like, that's what we want. And for whatever reason, USC has not been able to get to that.
Yeah.
USC's most consistent lineman, defensive lineman, last probably 4 or 5 years, was from Utah, Stevie Tuikolovatu, when he came as a grad transfer. I think part of it is you're playing two true defensive linemen, and you're asking two outside linebackers to stand up and play defensive end to an extent, but do some different things. So I think part of it is scheme there, but I think you're correct that there hasn't been someone that you scheme around in that interior, really. Whether it be your middle linebacker or, you know, Cam Smith's going to make a lot of tackles, but I don't know that you necessarily, we got to scheme around, right, make sure that guy doesn't make plays, where maybe Paliti and Itiote becomes that guy because he's such an aggressive player and someone who, you know, can make big plays. And we've seen last year him knocking both Laviska Shenault and himself out in the same play, that he's a willing hitter and stuff. And so I think the best players you've seen on USC have been the guys on the outside, whether it be Sua Cravens, who's kind of was that hybrid, you know, safety outside linebacker, or Adoree Jackson, are guys who are like, we'll stay away from that guy if we can, you know, because we don't want to see Adoree having a Notre Dame game against us and score in three different ways. But I just don't feel like those interior guys, they haven't found the scare factor, I guess, in there.
Yeah, and I think some of it was a challenge. You had a young defensive line coach in Kenichi, and that's a, you know, that's a big job to have, to be honest. You know, and I mean, I think there's when you're going up against an offensive line where it's constantly shifting and everything else, I think that's a Monday through Friday issue too. It's not just a recruiting issue. I think it's a Monday through Friday thing, and I don't think it's more on just the D-line coach. I think there's a lot of things that go into just that hasn't developed. You know, it just hasn't. You've got guys who looked good early on, and then, you know, I can't tell you how many times I feel like I drop by USC and I'll hear Dan Weber talk about some freshman, how great he looks. And then, you know, for whatever reason, that freshman doesn't turn out to, you know, when he's a junior, he's either not there, or like, I'm trying to remember who 21 was, who's from Florida. He was like,
Jamel Cook.
Yeah. It was like, oh, look at that guy. Well, that guy, you know, isn't here anymore. You know, and there's always that, feels like that guy who's like, keep an eye on him, and then doesn't quite happen.
Yeah.
I think particularly at the safety position, where USC's had so much turnover recently, you know, you guys like Bubba Bolden, you know, expect some big things out of Bubba Bolden when he transfers. Isaiah Polamalu had some good flashes early in the season before he gets injured in that Stanford game. So the safeties have really, the wow factor hasn't been there necessarily. There have been some consistent guys with Chris Hawkins and Leon McQuay. And Marvell Tell, like, I kind of expected Marvell Tell to make some bigger plays during his career, you know, game-changing type plays, because he's such an athlete and such a unique player.
I think one of the things we heard this in our coaches' meetings with them was Marvell Tell, one of the things, and maybe this is an excuse, maybe it's more of an explanation, of just like, he's had so many different guys. Like I think Hufanga comes out there, and they were telling us about a scrimmage where he was like, his head was all over the place. Now they think he's really talented and like him, but just, I think when you had a lot of guys who either weren't ready, or the pairing of the two safeties was like, kind of didn't have much chemistry, just because they, you know, didn't have a great feel for what the new guy was always going to do, because you had the turnover. I don't know. I just think it was just kind of a star-crossed year, where almost like everything that could go wrong was going to go wrong.
Yeah. We have a question on Facebook from Mike Connolly for you, Bruce. He says, in your opinion, what is USC's biggest area of need on the field or off of it?
I think their biggest area of need is they are not good enough on the O-line, which is a real head-scratcher. You know, when I moved out here in 2003, it wasn't long after that where, like, Ryan Khalil was there, and he was just a just an ass kicker in the middle of the, you know, he's from Orange County, middle of the offensive line. And he wasn't the prettiest thing, but there was a toughness and he was really good. And I feel like they had a lot of pieces around that. And like, that's kind of what I expected USC to look like from being somebody who grew up on the other side of the country and seeing great USC teams, what they had a really good offensive line. And it's not to say that they've had nobody, like they have guys who are talented. You know, you watch the Senior Bowl and Chuma Adoga, like he's certainly athletic, but you talk to other coaches who face them and they're kind of underwhelmed. And I think a function of that is just, like I said, so much turnover on, you know, the staff. Every year there's a new O-line guy there, and probably not a great feel for, like, this is another aspect of it. Like, you didn't feel like, what is USC's identity on offense, right? That was, there's like a disconnect there.
Yeah.
So I think that's the biggest issue, because it goes back to a little bit of the Utah feel. Like, they don't practice like Utah practices, right? It doesn't, it's just not, and I'm not saying Utah would beat USC 10 times out of 10. I don't, but in terms of just like Utah was getting almost everything they could out of that roster, where you just feel like USC is not, for whatever reason. And maybe they recruited guys who are high star guys who don't all love football, or they're distractions or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there's a myriad of reasons, but I feel like that's the biggest issue is, they haven't been, they've been so underwhelming on the offensive line, and it's a thing that, you know, carries over everything else, because I think the O-line sets the tone.
Yeah.
What's the biggest difference you see when you see Utah practice? Is it just is it tackling? Because we have people talk all the time about USC has to tackle more in practice. Now, they were very hampered by injuries last year. We kept a tally of the injuries. So many, at one point there was like 24 guys that were missing practice because of an injury. Now, part of that may be mindset. You know, there might be five guys in that group that probably could practice if they're pushed hard enough or whatever it may be. But what's the biggest difference? Is it just the tackling and the physicality of the practices?
I think it's the one-on-one physicality between the offensive line and the defensive line. I just think you see it, and you don't have to see it for 3 hours. You may see it for 10 minutes. You may see it for 10 reps, but it just, like, there's a tempo that's set and there's an energy that's there and it's different. And not to say that USC can't have that. It just feels like, and I can't say, you guys are out of practice every day. I'm not, mm-hmm. But just, you know, that's the thing. When you do go by there, it just didn't feel quite the same again. And maybe it is the injuries. Maybe that's like coaches, and I see this with Ogeron now that he's at LSU, where he's a different coach than he was when he was at Ole Miss. Because at Ole Miss, I remember they were going to be the most physical team in the world because they were going to go 100 miles an hour every day. And he's learned that you can't be that way. Sometimes you need to let off the gas. But you can't have your foot off the gas all the time, or else mm-hmm. eventually the car is going to stop in the middle of the road, right? So I think there are those moments and those spots where you go really, really hard and get after it. It's just, I think you got to know when to pull back on the throttle and when to really hit it. And I that's the part where I feel like Utah has a good feel for it. And I'm not saying they're the only place in the Pac-12 that has that. I mean, I see some of the energy at Washington when we go out there for games. Similar. It's very similar, actually.
Now, you mentioned the peristyle. The peristyle has been kind of split during the season about JT Daniels and their opinions of him. What was your evaluation of him throughout the season?
You know, he's really talented. I think he throws a good ball. I think the challenge with him is going to be, he was so anointed. Like, he had this great career at a great, you know, the quarterback school of all quarterback schools, right? And at modern day. The challenge, I think, is when you have so many people who have gotten in his ear at one point or another and have all these, you know, gurus or advisors or whatever, just to not get that watered down, where, you know, at some point, you know, you can't have too many people trying to groom you, right? Or else it's hard to manage that, especially if you're whatever, 18, 19 years old or whatever, 20 years old.
Yeah.
So I think that's the challenge for him. You know, now he's going to be on his second quarterback coach in 2 years there, and that's not going to be easy. You know, I think Graham will be good for him, but, you know, I just think it's a function of, just, he's got a lot of pressure on him, and that because of the everybody expected him to be great because he'd been played at such a high level, because the receivers were there, and because, you know, USC quarterbacks have been really good. Even when the teams haven't been that good, the USC quarterbacks, like, you know, what's the floor is going to be Cody Kessler. Cody Kessler's playing in the NFL now, right? Or I think he still is, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and the guy he followed was fantastic, right? So I just think that it's managing all the people around him that are going to try to help and just trying to just not try to do too much, just go out and play. Yeah. I mean, Darnold was really good at just going out and playing and not trying to do, you know, maybe he tried to do too much on the field, but it wasn't like, you know, he was overthinking things, I don't think.
That makes sense. We're reaching the top of the hour, so if you guys want to get your last minute rapid fire questions in, we will answer those. Shotgun, were there any YouTube questions?
That yeah, Jasper asked about Jalen Phillips committing. He did not commit to USC. He committed to Miami earlier tonight. So Jalen Phillips, obviously a guy that came out and at least one of the recruiting services was the number one player in the country, was super fun to watch. He was returning punts, you know, as a defensive end or an outside linebacker, however you want to use him. When Chip Kelly came in, obviously was not a good fit for him. The concussion issue at UCLA and how they've kind of, you know, put people, you know, out for the season after concussions and stuff. So he ends up transferring to Miami. They've got a little connection going on. You said he's pretty close with Bubba Bolden.
The Bishop Gorman guy. So Bubba Bolden transferred in there. Tate Martell transferred in there, and then I'm blanking on Jordan. Brevin Jordan, thank you. The tight end from Gorman. Like, I heard he's been a really good recruiter for UM, especially with a lot of these transfers. They also have Chidobe. Oh, God, I'm going to blank on his name. He was a backup defensive lineman for UCLA this year. He was a guy who did not fit in this system. He's a shorter defensive lineman. He was productive in 2017 when this staff wanted longer defensive lineman. He was more of a scout team guy, but he's already transferred to Miami as well. So we'll see. I mean, I don't know if he's going to be eligible right away. I don't know that part of it. But you know, it felt like it was going to be Miami all along. I think he was supposed to have visited out there about a month ago. Mm-hmm. And Miami's taken a lot of guys, and we'll see how it works out. I mean, Manny Diaz definitely has a lot of energy right now at UM going, and people are pretty fired up about it on this whole new Miami thing. So maybe a fresh start on the other side of the country will be a good thing for Jalen Phillips. I mean, Lord knows he's super athletic. I mean, you know, whatever, he's 6'5", 255, does flips. You know, it's just, you know, he could be a really special talent if he's really focused in and, you know, and it's a good system there for him.
We had a couple questions going back to the support personnel question. Jasper asked how many analysts are allowed for a school, and in his opinion, it should be illegal. And also Juan asked, how much is USC lacking in terms of support personnel compared to the likes of Alabama and Clemson, which we talked a little bit about. You know, the Clemson has 50 additional staff on the – or 50 additional people on the staff that are not coaches. Some of them are support, some of them administrative, but that's a lot. USC's number is – less than half of that.
Yeah, and a lot of those guys, like there's a guy I'm doing a story on now. He is an off-field, he is an analyst. Younger guys, probably 25. He was a student at Clemson. He will be a coach for somebody not that far down the road. One of the buddies he introduced me to is now, like, he's an on-field coach who went from analyst or GA, I think he was an analyst, to an FBS job at Charlotte. I mean, it's not a huge FBS program, but it's still, like, these are the guys they have, where I feel like you have kind of an engine room of really smart guys who are helping you in preparation and in game plan, and also a lot of other things that I think make the program go. I definitely feel like relative to, you know, the question to Clemson and Alabama, USC is way under-resourced compared to that. I'm not sure that they're much, I don't know if they're that different than the guys across town who don't have the same level of money to it. You know, I know UCLA has some really, you know, sharp guys who are off-field guys now in those roles as well. So I don't think it's that big of a difference. I don't think they have Dave Campo and Joe DeForest had been coaching for a long time in, like, those roles necessarily. But, you know, in that regard, they had it. I forgot what the first question was.
Was just how many analysts are allowed for a school?
You know, I don't even know if there's
I don't think there is a limit.
I don't think there is either. I just think it's a matter of what schools can fit under budget and what they want people around. Because it seems like it's a lot. There seems like there are schools that have a lot more now. You don't usually don't even know how many guys there are in some of these roles. So I know LSU didn't really up their commitment to that in the last couple of years, you know. And I want to say like one of their off-field guys last year is now like a head coach in the AAF right now in Atlanta. So I think they've, you know, had a bunch of guys that had opportunities, and you're kind of in the middle, and you sit there and go, okay, is there a coordinator here who's going to be a head coach somewhere, meaning that'll open up some space on the staff, or maybe I'll go with him. So you look at it as a networking opportunity, and while I'm there, you know, I can help out. And that's what's going on a lot.
I mean, Manny Diaz, you know, started basically being an analyst, had a job.
Not even, yeah. He started
ESPN, right?
Yeah, he would, because we were at ESPN together at the same time. Manny Diaz decided, you know, I always wanted to be a coach. I'm going to take a shot. And he couldn't really actually, because he'd already finished school, his wife was pregnant. He had a job, a regular 9-to-5. And then all he could do was like kind of address envelopes in the FSU recruiting office, did that for a while, and then stuck around. They got to know him, and then ended up getting on eventually. He was the tape guy, and then eventually got on as a GA when Chuck Amato got the NC State job.
Yeah. So we have a YouTube question that says, as of now, will USC be a preseason top 25 team?
I think it's going to be I think they may sneak in just because people know who JT Daniels is, and they don't think much of the Pac-12 South. I think they may be like 24th, 25th, but it's a toss up there, you know, just because you have a 5-7 team. We got asked this question on our podcast this week. Had there ever been a team that was 4-8 or worse in the go make it into the preseason top 25, and it was relative to Nebraska because they were, you know, because they were 4-8. Mm-hmm. And then we found out from one of our editors that I think the last time it happened was Alabama like 15 or 16 years ago. But even 5-7 teams usually don't see, you know, having that big of a optimist swing going into the year.
But USC is always the outlier. You've never seen a number one team finish 7-5 either and outside of the rankings. But USC still managed to do it. So
only at SC.
Yeah, they'll challenge the regularity of anything like that. So we do have some rapid fire questions. Is there some from Facebook? You ready?
Jacob on YouTube says, how do you get a team to buy in after a 5-7 season?
You better have good leadership, and you better have good leadership in your vision, because it's going to be hard. That's the hardest thing Clay Helton's going to have right now.
Change usually helps too. But, you know, they talked about how they wanted to change everything, and they truly didn't.
No, you still got John Baxter. You still got a lot of familiar faces. So I think it's going to be a challenge to flip that script.
John on Facebook says, are we getting anyone out of the transfer portal?
That'd be a you or Gerard question. I actually don't know that. So
they are still looking at some guys. We talked about the offensive lineman they're looking at. The guys that would be really good for them to get are guys like Parker Braun from Georgia Tech.
Everybody wants him.
Yes.
Yeah.
So a guy like that you could immediately eligible, and a guy that you could immediately stick in there and battle and take over a spot would be great for USC, but not necessarily any recent rumors about people coming to USC right now.
Tyrone on YouTube says, do you honestly think Clay Helton has the possibility to turn it around at USC?
The possibility, yeah. I think it's not a huge possibility. I think I would put the chance well under 50%, just because if he goes 9-3, I don't know if that's enough. It might be, but it might not be. And I look, you know, you look at the schedule, I don't think they're that much better than everybody else. I think they're more talented, but it's not like they're way more talented. And you look at what they just did. I mean, I think they're probably more 8-4, and I don't think that's going to be enough.
And the question, the wild card becomes Lynn Swann, because Lynn Swann has not made any big changes as an athletic director. So, and there was the opportunity there. Obviously, as I said earlier, if you go 5-7, that's a potentially fireable offense. Could have made the change there. They decided to stick with Clay Helton. He has been yet to make any big changes. So what would it take for that to happen is still kind of a question mark.
Yeah, my thing with Lynn Swann, my theory is he's a strong personality, and he did not want people to think that, like, he was going to stick to his guns, did not want to seem like he was wavering, and was not going to be like, I'm not going to let the fans dictate what happens here. And for better or worse, he is going to ride it out with Clay Helton. I just don't know how long that's going to last for both of them.
I mean, because everyone always mentions the Steeler tree and how the stability, I mean, at what point is stability unstable?
It's also the Steeler tree happened almost 40 years ago, right? So, I mean, when Lynn Swann was at Pittsburgh, when they were rolling, was the 70s. A lot of stuff was different then. I mean, you don't get Frank Beamer, who's a Hall of Fame coach, and I'm not saying this was wrong by Virginia Tech. They gave him a long, long time where there were some down years. Now that never would happen anywhere. So, and it's not going to happen when at a place where they weren't sure that you were the guy in the first place. Like, that's the thing. It's not like this is happening when, okay, we just hired Brian Kelly, who's coached in national title games, or they hired somebody else who was really successful and he's struggling. I mean, that's the part where I think the buy-in and the capital, I just don't know if he has that much. I genuinely think people like Clay Helton as a person.
Yeah.
I just don't think that they feel like he should be their football coach.
People get mad at us because we always go, he's such a nice guy, but you know, but you can't help it. If you're around him, that's what it is. On Facebook, Ty says, realistically, what's the best and worst case scenario for next season?
The worst case scenario is they have a challenging start and it goes bad early. And then all of a sudden you're looking and going, okay, are they trying to position themselves for who as a head coach? Like, you know, USC's had, you know, Ogeron was the interim coach for, like, I don't know, 6-7 games, maybe more than the, what was he, 6-2. So, you know, they've had firings where it's happened early, you know, and so that's just a bad place to be if you're the players, to be in the middle of that all over again. So to me, that's the worst case scenario. Now, I'm sure there's some of your folks on the message board who think the worst case scenario is he goes 9-3 and they keep him, because then all of a sudden they're in this limbo for another year. And like I said, I run into a lot of USC fans and they're like, they're disgusted with this because they just like want to rip the Band-Aid off. Mm. You know, it's like, just give me a change. They don't, you know, and I think a little of that was reflected on the recruiting part of it, where they just, it was a down by USC standards year recruiting. And you know, when you got kids going to Oregon and Washington that you normally get. So I think in some ways that might be the worst case scenario.
I mean, it begs the question of the administration, what are their goals? Is it just a safe 9-3 season, or is
it? It can't be that. I mean, it's USC. I'm sorry. It's like, you're not Arizona. You're not Arizona State. You're not Cal. You're USC. And you don't have the sanctions issue. The facilities are really good over there. I'm sorry. It's like, and again, this isn't a knock on Clay Helton or anything. The standard can't be, well, if it's 9-3, that's, you know, whatever. You're USC.
Yeah.
This is football. It's not basketball. Now, I don't want to sound like it's national championship or bust, but, I think they should expect to compete for the top 10 every other year. Yeah. It's not too much to ask, I don't think, in this place.
Yeah. But so the question that we still have is, does the administration want to help with that, or do they care? Not necessarily the athletic department, but just the above is, do you want to, you have to invest. You know, you see what is going on around the country and the investments made by programs, and USC, it feels like they had a toe in because it feels like,
we're not sure about, I don't know if this is a function of, well, we're not sure if Clay Helton's the guy, so we're not going to go all the way in. Like that part you said a while back about, you know, if Urban Meyer's going to be the coach or whatever, they need to approach it that way. If you're going to be serious about football, and that's such a big part of USC's identity, if you're going to half-ass it, you know, I just can't see the people they have enough big boosters who are going to be like, no, I don't, you know, mm-hmm. We're not going to operate that way.
Yeah. LDR on YouTube says, what kind of defense should USC run with the talent that they have, in your opinion?
You know, that's a tough question, because some of the stuff we talk about, you think, man, they look like they have 4-3 stuff out there instead of a 3-4. But, you know, you see a lot of teams winning with that. I think Clancy's a pretty good defensive coordinator. But, again, it just felt like they were really banged up in a way, you know, with the safeties and a lot of the key places. You know, we did the game where Porter Gustin was great, except, you know, he might not have been playing, and then he played, and then he couldn't get off the, like, I interviewed him in the post game,
yeah,
and he was stuck there in the middle of the field because there was no trainers around to, like, you know, it was like, he thought he was going to put his arm around Dan Weber and be carried off, like, the field, right? It was that bad. I don't know.
I was actually expecting Dan and Keeley to have a Kellen Winslow moment, you know, carry him off the field, but
we were
fortunately
there.
They missed out on that opportunity.
We were there. We have some odd questions for you. Tyrone wants to know, do you think pineapples belong on pizzas?
I do.
Oh,
I do. I'm a pineapple Canadian bacon person.
I'm not in that boat. Really? One of the questions earlier was, are we going to see Solo play this year? That'd be Solomon Tuliapupu. Excited to see him, actually, because we expected him to be back last year, and he had a foot injury and just kept, you know, lingering his rehab. But he expected to be participating in spring practice. He has been practicing with the group, so expect to see him out there. That's a guy I'm looking forward to seeing. I don't know how much you had heard of him as a, you know, coming out of high school, but I think he's a guy that can come in and make an impact.
Yeah, the guy I'm most curious to see how he develops is EA, just because, yeah, you know, when we do our meetings with them, this is the next great USC linebacker. You know, I thought I learned how to say his name right in the beginning of the game of Colorado, and then I butchered it. But like, you know, that guy has a suddenness and a different, you know, like a different level, you know, kind of linebacker. And if he's potentially better than Ray Maaluga, you know, with some of the same kind of ferocious hittings, you know, with some of the stuff we've seen a little bit of, that's the stuff that can be a tempo setter, you know, and that's been missed.
Yeah.
Brian had an interesting question from Peristyle, or the Periscope, excuse me. Have you heard what other staff say about USC as far as things like negative recruiting?
You know, I think the probably thing you'd hear the most this year is he's not going to be there very long. I mean, I don't think that's hard to sell. You know, when you have that much turnover there on the staff where people think he's going to be gone.
And especially he's a guy that recruits usually like, and recruits parents really like Clay Helton, because he's more involved than a lot of head coaches are in the recruiting process. He calls up prospects himself instead of position coach calls a guy and then hands the phone to Nick Saban or
right.
to Urban Meyer or somebody. He's a guy that does a lot of the footwork himself. And a lot of families really enjoy him and love having him in the house and all that type of thing. But you know, if he's one of the main attractors to you to come to USC, that makes it that much more difficult to go there if you're really worried about him and where he's going to be.
Yeah, and when everybody's saying your head coach is going to get fired, I mean, that's no matter – you can't bank and say, oh, well, I'm going to go there and then next year Urban Meyer's coming or next year James Franklin's coming or whoever. It's just the uncertainty of it, you know, and I think that's hard sell for anybody. I don't think it's hard to negative recruit that.
And if you're an elite player, usually you can go anywhere and fit into a system. But you look at a guy like Dominic Davis, who came in as a running back. Steve Sarkisian brought him in, wanted to use him in a slot role. And I think he would have been really good in that role. But that role kind of disappeared with Clay Helton. And you've seen he disappear basically on the roster. And now he's back. And now he's playing DB. He hasn't played a single snap of defensive back. So,
well, I remember where he was committed before. And he would have caught a lot of passes at Washington State, and he probably would have been about as dynamic an athlete as they have out there because he was a legit track guy. And he's another one where you see, you know, there's guys where you go out there, and it's different for me because it's almost like when you go out there, you know, once a month, you're like, oh, yeah, that guy's there. And then, you know, you'll see a little flash of them, and then, you know, it just won't translate in the games or they won't be real impactful. You know, so it's like enough to remember, but not much more than that. Mm-hmm. And that's just you got to find a way to get those guys going. I mean, look, when they had the coaching change, when Lane was here, he didn't, I think it was Buck Allen was a good example. Like, he was not a big Buck Allen guy. Well, Tommy Robinson was, and he started playing him, and Buck Allen turned out to be a really productive, good running back. I mean, most of these guys are at USC for a reason. It's just a matter of how do they fit in and how, you know, how much, and it's not to say it's all the coach's fault. Sometimes a kid could be a knucklehead or not mature enough or whatever, but you know, you look at him like, oh, there's a reason why this guy's probably here.
Yeah. Alrighty. Any final thoughts, Shotgun, from YouTube?
I think we're pretty good over here at YouTube and Periscope. So.
Alrighty.
Thank you guys so much for joining us.
And
thank
thanks
you
to Bruce.
Bruce.
Yeah, thank you so much for filling in for Ryan, the knucklehead, going to a Lakers game tonight.
I know.
But you filled in admirably, so we thank you very much.
Thanks for being an improvement. You know.
Hey, from one gray-haired guy to another, I figured I could pick up the slack for Ryan, so.
Of course. Well, thank you so much, and thanks, Shotgun, for providing your analysis, as always.
We'll be back next Wednesday. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, we'll be back Wednesday. Wednesdays from now on, because spring camp will start soon, less than 2 weeks away, which is pretty crazy. But yeah, stay tuned for more. Ryan will be back. Shotgun, are you leaving yet? Shotgun's
I'll be
all
back
over
next Wednesday.
Place. He's traveling and getting married, you know, low-key things for
Mr. Whoa, I don't know what you're talking about.
Mr.
There.
Shotgun over there.
I'll be in San Diego tomorrow. I'll be in Vegas on Saturday, back in San Diego on Sunday. You know, there'll be a trip to Atlanta, then I'll be in Clemson. So, yeah, it's going to be a fun 2 weeks going on here.
What are these San Diego-Vegas trips?
Baseball. Oh, okay. Covering college baseball.
That's the
main. I'm heading to the USC baseball game from here, so.
So maybe we should wrap this up.
Yeah, and USC basketball is actually leading in half, 30-25 on Oregon.
Alrighty, well, that's Shotgun, that's Bruce, I'm Keely. Thank you so much for watching, and we'll see you guys next week.